Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Scott. Barry has the day off. And for the next 60 minutes, we'll focus on some of this week's important business news from around the world, the nation, and the state. We'll turn first to the Sunday, April 21st issue of the New York Times, their business section, when 401k returns leave something to be desired. Over the course of a career, costly fees and limited options can shrink the balance. Chris Gentry is meticulous about his craft. He's a professional woodworker at a small company in Brooklyn that makes custom dining and coffee tables, cabinets, and interiors. He creates pieces on his own from start to finish and enjoys that freedom. It's nice to have control over the way something should be done, he said. Gentry, 36, is equally conscientious about saving for retirement. He's contributed the maximum allowable amounts to his employer's 401k plan over the past 2 years and also topped out a Roth individual retirement account. He hopes to buy an apartment and start a family soon with his partner. It seems like all that will be expensive, so I'm trying to get an early start on retirement savings while I can, he said. Between the two accounts, he's managed to save $80,000. His employer kicks in a generous 5% of his salary to the 401k, no matter how much Mr. Gentry contributes, but he worries about the plan's high-cost mutual funds. They're expensive compared with what I can get in the IRA, he said. He even wonders if he should contribute to the plan at all. I'm not sure how to determine at what point the fees become so expensive that the benefits of the 401k are outweighed by the fees. Fees are one of the most important factors of successful retirement investing. They determine how much ends up in your pocket after mutual funds and 401k plan providers take their cut. The bite especially hurts younger workers who face the risk that high fees will compound over time. Fees compound in the same way that returns compound, said Scott Puritz, managing director of Rebalance, a firm that often works with clients on 401k rollovers and advises companies on ways to improve their plans. People are numb to the differences, but it's a major determinant of long-term returns. Costs are usually much higher in plans sponsored by small businesses, like the 10-person firm where Gentry works. His plan doesn't offer low-cost passive index fund choices. He's invested solely in a target date fund made up of actively managed mutual funds, which have lagged behind the overall market's returns during the past decade. The fund charges an annual expense fee of just over 1%. That amount is typical for small plans, according to data compiled for the 401k averages book, which surveys companies that provide plans to employers. For example, the survey shows that among plans with 10 participants and $1 million in assets, average investment costs are 1.10%. At larger firms, those fees are far lower. At companies with 1,000 to 5,000 plan participants, target date fund fees average just 0.33%. That's according to data compiled by the Investment Company Institute and Brightscope. Target date funds shift gradually toward bonds from stocks as a worker approaches an expected date for retirement. It's not unusual for small plans to carry total expenses far higher. We often see plans that charge 2 or 3% all in all, sometimes more, Mr. Puritz said. A key reason for the varying amount of fees is the fixed costs of administering a plan and how those costs are spread across companies of different sizes. If I have a small coffee shop plan with $100,000 in assets, the costs are spread across fewer people compared with a very large company, said Joe Valletta, principal with Pension Data Source, which publishes the 401k averages book. The big plan has higher fixed costs, but it's spread over a lot more employees and a larger asset base. Mr. Gentry is fortunate to work for an employer that offers any kind of plan. Only about half of private sector U.S. workers are covered by an employer retirement plan at any given time. And the gap is driven by lower participation in the system by small employers, according to the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Workers often gain and lose coverage as they change jobs. The coverage gap helps explain why many workers reach retirement with savings unlikely to last the rest of their lives. According to the Federal Reserve, the median retirement account holdings for workers age 55 to 64 was $185,000 in 2022. But fees also play a leading role, especially for young workers who face the compound effects over many years of saving. The difference in account balances when they retire can be staggering. The New York Times worked with Rebalance to create a hypothetical example illustrating the career-long effect of plans with a variety of fee levels. We considered a 28-year-old worker with a starting salary of $75,000 who saves diligently in her 401k account throughout the career. She contributes 6% of her salary annually and receives a 3% matching contribution from her employer. The scenario shows the effect of what she will have at three possible retirement ages. At 65, her portfolio is nearly 66% smaller in a high-cost plan compared with the lowest. Determining the fees that you pay is not simple. Fees can be charged for plan administration, investments, and sometimes for individual services provided to participants. All 401k plans are required to send an annual notice that explains the fees that can be deducted from your account, but understanding them is another matter. But asking your employer about fees is a good starting point. You have the right to know what you're paying, so go out to your human resources department, ask them to tell you about your options and what they cost, said Mr. Puritz, the managing director at Rebalance. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority offers an online tool that analyzes how fees and other expenses affect the value of mutual funds and exchange-traded funds over time. If your employer's plan offers an annual matching contribution, save enough to capture it. Doing otherwise leaves money on the table. If they are matching dollar for dollar or 50 cents on the dollar, that's a 100% or 50% return with almost zero risk, said Heath Biller, a financial planner with Fiduciary Financial Advisors in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You can also push for change. Mediocre 401k plans can get better. Employers are usually the fiduciary with the legal responsibility to consider only the interest of participants, and it's in their own best interest to take your misgivings under consideration. You can raise your concerns about high fees or poor investment options with your employer and ask if the company is able to consider adjustments, Mr. Biller said. And after you've captured the employer match, consider low-cost options outside your 401k for additional saving. This year, you can contribute up to $23,000 to a 401k, $7,000 to an IRA. Savers 50 and older can contribute more via catch-up contributions. Eligibility to deduct the IRA contributions phases out at certain income levels. Establishing one low-cost IRA lets you roll balances over to a single account as you change jobs through the course of your career, which is a great way to stay organized. And taxable investment accounts offer another route around IRA contribution limits, especially for older retirement savers. Unlike 401k and IRA accounts, they don't come with an upfront tax benefit. Investment gains are subject to capital gains rates, although these are more favorable than ordinary income tax rates imposed on withdrawal from tax-deferred accounts. It's also possible to use tax-efficient investments in taxable accounts, such as broad market equity exchange-traded funds, which have become very tax-efficient, and municipal bonds, which generally are not subject to federal income taxes, for fixed income, Ms. Benn said. It's not that difficult to simulate some of the tax sheltering characteristics of a tax-deferred account in a taxable account, she said. Well, now on to the Wednesday, April 24th edition of the JI, Their Business Pages. This by Lise Klein. Connecticut gas prices jumped 21 cents in a week. Gas prices in Connecticut have climbed 21 cents in the past week and may inch up more as the summer driving season approaches, according to AAA. A gallon of self-service regular in the state averaged $3.71 on Tuesday morning. That's up 21 cents from the week before, 29 cents from a month ago. The highest prices were reported in Windham County, Lower Fairfield, and the Greater Bridgeport area, the Travel and Auto Club Agency reported. Part of the surge is due to the recent switch from winter blend gasoline, which makes it easier to start your car in cold weather, to the more pricey summer blend, which causes less air pollution. The bottom line is that the summer blend fuel is designed to have lower emissions but is more costly to produce, said Alec Slatke, Managing Director of Public and Government Affairs for AAA Northeast. Demand due to spring and summer travel also tends to boost gas prices, with a 20-cent jump seen last year around this time. On the positive side, global oil prices have gone down in recent days due to developments in the Middle East, where a wider war between Israel and Iran appears to have been averted for now. We'll see where it goes, because hopefully that will temper the price increases a little bit, Slatke said. Regional gas inventories are also up, he said, which could further help temper surges. As of Monday, the average gas price nationwide was $3.67, up 4 cents from the week before and 14 cents from last month. Connecticut ranked 14th on AAA's list of states with the highest average gas prices, California at $5.43 a gallon, Hawaii at $4.78 a gallon, topping the list. This week's higher price is still far short of recent price records in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and inventory shortages in 2022 in the wake of the pandemic. According to AAA, the state's highest average price was $4.98 a gallon. That was on June 14, 2022. Well, fashion retailer Express has filed for bankruptcy, and it is set to close approximately 95 of its Express retail stores, including several in Connecticut. Four Express locations in the state are set to close: the Express store at Danbury Fair Mall, the Express Factory Outlet store at the Shops at Buckland Hills in Manchester, the Express Edit store at 181 Greenwich Avenue in Greenwich, and the Express Edit store at 125 Main Street in Westport. That's according to a list of planned closings that was included in one of the company's bankruptcy filings on Monday. Closing sales are set to begin on Tuesday. Ultimately, the debtor's management team and advisors determined that it is appropriate to close and wind down approximately 95 underperforming brick-and-mortar stores, with the potential to close and wind down additional stores in the future. The debtors expect all sales at the initial closing stores to be completed and the properties vacated by June 30th. The list did not include the Express stores at Connecticut Post Mall in Milford, Trumbull Mall, and West Farms Mall on the Farmington-West Hartford line, or the Express Factory Outlet stores at Clinton Premium Outlets and Tanger Outlets at Foxwoods and Mashantucket, indicating those stores will stay open at least for the time being. Express is also planning to close all of its Up West stores, but it doesn't have any Up West establishments in Connecticut. Increasing competition from fast fashion retailers like H&M, combined with the rise of Old Navy and athleisure brands like Lululemon, affected Express sales, said Neil Saunders, managing director with research firm Global Data. Saunders also said that Express faced quality issues and that the pandemic sparked increase in people working from home reduced the need for shoppers to buy work outfits. Everyone's been nibbling at Express from all sides, and Express doesn't have a defensible proposition, Saunders said. Express joined several other retailers that have filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this year. The group also includes a fabrics and craft seller, Joanne, which said last month it was keeping its stores open. Now, from the Thursday, April 25th issue of the JI, again from their business pages, major insurer downsizes its suburban campus. The shift to remote work has emptied out a major office building in Farmington as the greater Hartford area office market continues to stall, according to a recent report by commercial broker CBRE. Kineticare, which built its corporate headquarters at 175 Scott Swamp Road in 2009, is vacating Building 1 at the site and shifting about 500 workers to Building 2. That puts 64,000 square feet of office space on the market, pushing up vacancy in the region. Post-pandemic, we adopted a hybrid work model and no longer require as much office space as we did in the past, Kineticare spokesperson Kimberly Kahn said. Valued at the time of construction at $24.4 million, 175 Scott Swamp Road sold for $13.5 million to a New Jersey-based company in 2022. Kineticare's downsizing capped a slow first quarter for office rentals in Greater Hartford, with leasing activity dropping 19% compared to the last quarter of 2023. What leasing there was dominated by rental of Class A space, continuing a recent trend as office tenants seek newer construction and more amenities for their money. West Hartford Center and Glastonbury Boulevard are the two areas benefiting most from the flight to quality by office tenants, with the highest rents and lowest vacancy rates in Greater Hartford, said John McCormick, Executive Vice President in CBRE's Hartford office. What we're seeing is a concerted effort by senior leadership to figure out how to optimize their office space as a way to retain existing employees, as well as to attract the next level of talent to these particular businesses. But a shift in methods sparked by the remote work trend has had a major impact on CBRE's recent analysis of the Greater Hartford market. The change reflects the broker's methodology in the region, but had an outsized impact in Hartford due to the nature of the region's office inventory. Nearly 4.5 million square feet of new office space was added to CBRE's equation on office vacancy for the first quarter after the broker decided to include owner-occupied buildings to its calculations. That means the Hartford's 1.2 million square foot headquarters at 1 Hartford Plaza is now considered part of the leasing market, reflecting the national trend of companies subleasing and downsizing within their own buildings. But the new measurement doesn't hide the fact that sections of Hartford's downtown have nearly 50% vacancy in office buildings, and the region as a whole has seen major corporate downsizing, McCormick said. Major leases that were not renewed in the first quarter included a 34,000-square-foot space at 1 Constitution Plaza, a building embroiled in bankruptcy filings involving its New York-based owner. On the positive side, downtown Hartford saw the largest new lease of the quarter, 26,000 feet rented by an as-yet-to-be-named tenant in the Gold Building at 755 Main. And the Hartford region's industrial market has also cooled off as major national players like Amazon continue to scale back expansion amid economic uncertainty. The online retailer has delayed development of planned warehouses in Waterbury and elsewhere in the state in recent months. First quarter industrial leasing dropped sharply. Vacancy rose to 4.1% in Greater Hartford, That's according to CBRE's first quarter report. But homegrown demand remained strong for industrial space across the state, even as national players put the brakes on expansion. Our large box distribution and warehousing is continuing to outperform other parts of the country, McCormick said. Because of all the advanced manufacturing that's done in Connecticut, it's very hard to find industrial space. Now, from the Tuesday, April 23rd issue of the New York Times, their business section, The Future Beyond Ozempic. This from Denmark. Lars Fruergaard Jorgensen has a problem. Too many people want what he's selling. Mr. Jorgensen is the chief executive of Novo Nordisk, the Danish drug maker. Even if the company isn't quite a household name, the TV jingle for its best-selling drug, Ozempic, across the United States, Novo Nordisk's diabetes and weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, have soared to celebrity status and helped make the company Europe's most valuable public firm. It can't make enough of the drugs. Mr. Jorgensen's problem is one many top executives wouldn't mind, but the success caught him off guard. Last year, when the company was celebrating its centenary, Novo Nordisk's revenue jumped by a third to 232 billion Danish kroner, or $33 billion. Nobody forecast this growth, no analyst, nobody in the company. Mr. Jorgensen said in a recent interview at the company's headquarters in a suburb of Copenhagen, nobody forecast a 100-year-old company would grow more than 30%, he said, seemingly torn between pride and amazement. For most of its 100 years, Novo Nordisk has been focused on the steady business of treating diabetes, one of the world's most prevalent chronic diseases. Even today, it produces half the world's insulin. But the development of Ozempic and Wegovy has led to a bigger and bolder ambition to defeat serious chronic diseases. And that includes treating and even preventing obesity, which is linked to other health issues like heart and kidney diseases. By pursuing a much larger target than diabetes, the company expects to unlock the door to a multi-billion-dollar market with nearly a billion potential patients. In the U.S. alone, more than 40% of adults are obese. And so the Danish drug maker is undergoing vast changes. It's getting bigger, more international, and closer to the heat of the spotlight. Mr. Jorgensen is trying to ramp up production to meet the huge demand for its weight loss drugs, stay ahead of competition from Eli Lilly and others, and ensure the company's future so it can meet its lofty goal. By far, most people using Ozempic, two-thirds of its sales last year, and Wegovy, nearly all of its sales, are in the U.S. That's partly because drugs tend to be introduced first in the United States. The cost of these drugs, though, has made Novo Nordisk a target. There is no rational reason other than greed for Novo Nordisk to charge Americans nearly $1,000 a month for Ozempic, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, said last month. A frequent critic of high drug prices, he said Canadians paid $155 a month, Germans $59 a month. Ozempic could be a game-changer, fighting diabetes and obesity, Mr. Sanders added. But this outrageously high price has the potential to bankrupt Medicare, the American people, and our entire healthcare system. And while the U.S. list price for Ozempic is a little under $1,000 a month, about $1,350 for Wegovy, about $1,350 for Wegovy, Novo Nordisk says most American patients pay $25 or less for Wegovy. Much of the rest of the cost is shouldered by insurance plans, and some have been overwhelmed. This month, facing ballooning costs, North Carolina quit providing insurance coverage for obesity drugs for state employees. Even Denmark's National Health Service won't subsidize Wegovy, arguing it isn't cost-effective. Now from the Thursday, April 25th USA Today, their money section, costs of child care keep increasing. A new report says American families that pay for child care spend nearly one-fifth of their income on the service. The costs are rising. The average household with child care bills spends $325 a week, 18.6% of its weekly income. That's according to an analysis by LendingTree, a personal finance site. In Nevada, the costliest child care state, families spend 32.3% of their income, an average of $493 a week, for others to tend their children. Child care expenses eat up more than one-fifth of parental income in eight other states, including Illinois, Louisiana, and Texas, the report found. Several economic factors have pushed up costs and stretched supply in the child care industry, experts say. One is inflation, which has raised prices in the past few years. Another is the pandemic, which shuttered thousands of child care centers. A third is the expiration of pandemic-era federal funding for child care centers last fall, a cutback observers liken to a child care cliff. You're listening to the Chris Business Hour. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Pete Anderson will have the mic, and he'll have articles from the most recent issue of the Hartford Business Journal.
The American School for the Deaf Online Academy is the first accessible online education platform for deaf and hard of hearing students, serving over 200 students from around the world. It offers core academic subjects for middle and high school students, tutoring, enrichment programs, and American Sign Language as a world language courses for public schools. The program recently expanded to also provide accessible support services, including speech therapy and counseling. This telecare program offers direct access to therapeutic services for deaf and hard of hearing school-aged children without the need for an interpreter or third party. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf. Always able.
Windsor's Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum, with the help of the Windsor Lions Club and Chris Radio, has set up 18 Chris Access readers describing various exhibits for low vision and print disabled individuals. With input from the low vision population and working with a teacher of low vision and print disabled individuals, we have also improved the accessibility of these readers with highly visible markers on the floor. To access the QR code, just open the camera option on your phone, scan the QR code, and press Enter once the link is shown. Please be aware that cell phone coverage in Northwest Park, where the Tobacco Museum is located, is limited, so please stop by the archive building to get the Wi-Fi password. If you or someone you know are interested in using this unique feature, please call the Tobacco Museum at 860-285-1888 or email windsorconnecticutmuseum@gmail.com. The Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum is located in Windsor's Northwest Park, 135 Lang Road, and is open Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 4 p.m. through the last week of October.
I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the April 15th, 2024 edition of the Hartford Business Journal. The first story is titled Liability Offset. The story is Here's Why Insurers Like Connecticut's Film Production Tax Credit. In addition to major pushback from sports media giant ESPN and other film industry representatives, a proposal to eliminate Connecticut's film production tax credit has also drawn opposition from one of the incentive's main beneficiaries, insurance companies that purchase the credits to offset their own state tax liability. House Bill 5110, which was introduced by the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, proposes to repeal the state's digital media and motion picture tax credit, which offers tax credits to production companies that spend at least $100,000 in Connecticut. The proposal didn't move out of the committee before deadline, but could still be introduced in another bill being considered by lawmakers. The tax credit has been repeatedly targeted by advocacy groups and some legislators who say its economic benefits aren't worth the cost. Connecticut's film production tax credit has been awarded to over $1.5 billion to production companies since 2007. According to one estimate from House Majority Leader Jason Rojas, a Democrat from East Hartford, its tax credits have had a negative impact on more than $500 million on the state budget since it began, including a $11.5 million loss in fiscal year 2023. Rojas is among the lawmakers pushing for the tax credit's repeal. But the incentive has many supporters, including insurers, that do business in the state. Both the Insurance Association of Connecticut and the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies voiced opposition to the repeal, noting that the film production tax credit is one of the most popular tax credits insurers purchase to offset their state tax liability. In 2022, for example, insurers claimed 40 film production tax credits worth $40.4 million to offset their insurance premium tax, which is assessed on insurance policies sold in Connecticut, according to recent data from the State Department of Revenue Services, or DRS. Over a 10-year period ending in 2022, insurers claimed 454 film production tax credits worth $396.4 million to offset their insurance premium taxes, DRS data shows. Film production tax credits can also be used against the state's corporation business tax. In 2021, companies claimed 34 film production tax credits worth $55.4 million to offset their corporate business tax obligations, according to DRS data. On an annual basis, companies can use film tax credits to offset up to 50% of their total corporate tax liability and up to 55% of their insurance premiums tax liability. Like all businesses and taxpayers, insurance carriers are keenly aware of the financial burden that state tax liability can have on the business operations of their organization and their affiliates, the Insurance Association wrote in joint testimony supporting the film production tax credit. State tax liability is not an insignificant factor in the cost of doing business, and insurance carriers, like many taxpayers, seek methods to manage their state tax liability. They added that eliminating the film tax credit would be detrimental and harmful for those insurance carriers. Hartford, of course, is still known as a dominant center of the global insurance industry and is home to major insurers including the Hartford, Travelers, and Aetna. Over 1,300 insurers paid $254.3 million in premium taxes in fiscal year 2023, which ended on June 30th, DRS data shows. Connecticut has three separate film tax credits. Insurers have also purchased film infrastructure tax credit, which incentivizes the construction of facilities used by digital media and motion picture companies. However, the film production tax credit is much more widely used. It offers credits to production companies that spend at least $100,000 on motion pictures, documentaries, TV series, music videos, commercials, miniseries, video games, or other forms of media. Eligible companies must conduct at least 50% of principal photography days within the state and expend at least 50% of post-production costs within Connecticut. Productions that have between $100,000 and $500,000 in expenses qualify for up to 10% tax credit. $500,000 to $1 million in expenses qualify for a 15% tax credit, and $1 million or more in expenses qualify for a 30% tax credit. Connecticut awarded 36 film production tax credits worth more than $103.9 million in fiscal year 2023, according to the State Department of Economic and Community Development, or DECD, which administers the program. Companies that were granted the tax credit spent more than $335.3 million on qualified projects. A key part of the initiative program is the ability of film production companies to sell or transfer the tax credits. John Lanza is a partner at Cohen Resnick, who leads the accounting and consulting firm's Business Tax Credits and Incentives Group in Stanford. He said that since film production companies often aren't structured in ways to utilize the tax credits, mainly because they're not set up as C-Corps that pay corporate business taxes, they sell the credits, typically through brokers, to other companies that can benefit from them. In a lot of instances, film tax credits that are generated in the state of Connecticut are transferred to insurance companies in the state of Connecticut, Lanza said. It's going from one Connecticut entity that doesn't pay any corporate tax or insurance premium tax, and then it's transferred, because the law allows that, to another entity that does not pay that tax. Peter Downing, a national principal in charge of tax credits and incentives at accounting and advisory firm Marcum, said there are exchange marketplaces where the film production tax credits can be sold for cash. It reduces their investment, Downing said, of film production companies. We're dealing with millions of dollars here of spent costs for production, so if I can get $300,000 or $400,000 back in the sale of credits, then that helps the production company, because they go on, sell the movie off to an investor group, and then these guys run their next sprint. Downing said the film tax credit has been a positive for film production companies and insurers, but he also acknowledged it's costing the state roughly $100 million a year. $100 million is a big number, and if you're having budget issues or you've got to balance a budget, these programs can get chopped, Downing said. Lawmakers have been debating adjustments to the state's two-year, $26 billion budget that passed in June. And their ability to spend more money is constrained by spending and borrowing caps that were adopted in 2017. That led some lawmakers to target the film production tax credit for elimination, so more money can be funneled to other areas like education and health care. But Downing said that because the state is home to major media production companies, getting rid of the tax credit isn't simple. A 2022 study published by DECD concluded that the state's three film incentive programs have led to job and personal income growth, as well as a rise in the state's economic output. Sports media giant ESPN, which employs thousands of people at its main campus in Bristol, received more than $15.3 million in film tax credits in fiscal year 2023, according to DECD. The company ranks behind NBC's four subsidiaries that were issued $38.7 million in credits last year, and just ahead of the $15 million collected by Stanford-based World Wrestling Entertainment. Downing said while companies such as ESPN probably wouldn't fully leave the state if production tax credit were eliminated, they would likely be more reluctant to expand in Connecticut in the future. Downing and Con Resnick's Lanza also said that without the film tax credits, insurance companies would have to search for other eligible tax credits to buy, or simply pay more in state taxes, hurting Connecticut's economic competitiveness. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This story is titled Open Field. It's subtitled Stanford's Collegiate Sports Management Group Finds Growth at Intersection of Media, Sports, and Technology. So, have you filled out your May Madness bracket yet? That's not a typo. While March Madness, also known as the NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments, wrapped up recently, it captivated even more non-sports fans' attention nationwide for 3 weeks in March and early April. May Madness, on the other hand, kicks off next month and will mostly captivate gamers and fans of electronic sports or esports. Unlike the basketball tournaments, which now feature 68 teams, May Madness will have 84 Division I, II, III, and junior college teams competing for the Collegiate Esports Commissioner's Cup at Esports Stadium, Arlington, in Texas, from May 3 through 5. And for the second year in a row, the event is sponsored by McDonald's. That's music to the ears of Michael Schreck, co-founder and CEO of Stanford-based Collegiate Sports Management Group, or CSMG, which owns the tournament. While CSMG is a relatively small company with just 25 employees and a half a dozen contractors, it has grown rapidly since its 2015 inception. In addition to its esports vertical, formed nearly 5 years ago and now the largest scholastic esports platform in the nation, CSMG also represents 11 NCAA sports conferences and more than 100 universities and colleges for their regional, national, and international media rights. Schreck said the NCAA does not yet sanction esports, so his organization serves as the governing structure for the largest scholastic event of its kind in the nation. We basically created May Madness, he said, which began in 2021 with a 32-team bracket, expanded to 64 the following year, and will have 84 teams competing this year. The first event was held virtually due to the pandemic, then it was held in Atlanta before finding a home in Texas. One of the coolest parts about this is that we decided to go back there even though 17 different cities bid for us to bring the event there, Schreck said. Given how well the University of Connecticut's men's and women's basketball teams performed during March Madness, you might wonder if UConn even had an esports team. Of course, Schreck said, not as good as the basketball teams, though. Schreck, a Long Island native, began his career as a New York Mets executive, selling sponsorships and hospitality suites. He then spent 9 years with CBS-owned Westwood's One Sports Radio Network, running its digital and audio divisions. He left in 2015 and found CSMG with Ray Katz, a Brooklyn native and longtime sports marketing executive who spent time with the NFL and Disney, as well as running an agency called Optimum Sports. The reason we started the company was there were a lot of what I call open field and white space opportunities, Schreck said, during a recent interview with the Hartford Business Journal. While sports marketing and media companies IMG and Learfield dominate the media rights playing field for major college sports programs and the so-called Power Five conferences, those are the Atlantic Coast, Big Ten, Big 12, Pac-12, and Southeastern conferences, the mid-major and lower division schools were in need of help, Schreck said. I saw a void in the marketplace, he said. The mid-majors Division I, Division II, Division III, and junior college schools needed help with commercialization. They don't have the staff or the bandwidth to understand how to generate sponsorship revenues or media revenue or ticketing and licensing. So Schreck and Katz set out to fill the void. While CSMG was new and an unknown player, Schreck could rely on experience he gained with Westwood One in negotiating a lot of NCAA rights agreements, he said. I was fortunate to meet several conference commissioners, school athletic directors, and executives in the business along the way, he said. Some of those commissioners, he said, were innovative and forward-thinking enough to say, hey, we can use your help, so we'll sign an agreement with you. The first to sign was the East Coast Conference, followed by Division I Colonial Athletic Conference, led by Commissioner Joe D'Antonio, a longtime Schreck acquaintance. Mike and I had a previous relationship, D'Antonio said, not a business relationship, but we had a relationship just knowing each other through some mutual friends. That created some trust for him to steer his conference into a deal with CSMG. When I first started as commissioner, we had inherited an entity that we worked with, and that relationship came to an end. And we began our relationship with CSMG as it related to our media rights, D'Antonio said, adding that he knew he could trust Schreck to treat the conference well. It was a unique situation for us to be involved with an upstart entity and know that it would have focus and the time and the dedication we needed, he said. It was CSMG that helped the Colonial Conference sign a seven-figure media rights deal with Flow Sports, a sports streaming service. The conference also has a very competitive deal with CBS Sports Network, D'Antonio said. While CSMG no longer has the ECC as a client, it has added numerous others, including the Big Sky, the East Coast Athletic, and Horizon Conferences. It added Division I Atlantic Sun Conference in February. "We've made many pivots along the way," Schreck said. "What started off focused on D2 and D3 quickly became more focused on Division I because the amount of money wasn't there in D2 and D3. While they began with a focus on traditional sports like basketball, football, baseball, hockey, and soccer, they also pivoted to esports. The esports events, which included a major qualifying tournament at the Ohio State University held on April 12th and 13th, have helped CSMG continue to grow. It now has satellite offices across the country with one or two salespeople, as well as content production studio in Hawaii." Schreck declined to discuss the company's revenue, saying only that it's in the millions of dollars. But he did note that the length of conference contracts keeps income flowing. "It's like a multi-year annuity," he said, "because if we negotiate a 5, 6, or 7-year deal with a TV network, we're compensated for the term of the deal. Right now, we have revenue through that side of the business all the way out to 2030. CSMG has also gotten involved in the name, image, and likeness, or NIL, side of the collegiate sports, which allows athletes to sign promotional contracts while still in school. CSMG has partnered with Open Doors, a largest software as a service and company in NIL, which athletes and schools use to ensure they are in compliance with NCAA rules. CSMG has also helped broker endorsement deals, including one with Kraft Macaroni and Cheese for a few members of the Louisiana State University football team. But its biggest success in NIL has been in esports," Schreck said, "including the sponsorship deal with McDonald's. There have been other deals in the works," he said, "including a pending linear television contract to broadcast its esports content. Currently, CSMG's esports competitors are streamed live via Twitch TV and YouTube. The company also recently was approved for a $1.4 million investment by the Connecticut Innovations, the state's quasi-public venture capital arm. Neither CSMG nor CI would comment on the investment." Schreck said there's a lot of stuff in the works that will help CSMG grow. "The nice part about us is that because we live at the intersection of media, sports, and technology, there's a lot of different things for us to be looking at," he said. Continuing now with the subject of sports, this story is titled "Major Sports Facility Campus Eyed for Middletown Property." The owner of Vail Sports Club considering the purchase of a Middletown property on which he would consolidate his indoor and outdoor recreational facilities. Zach Gettinger said if his special exception application is approved by the Middletown Planning and Zoning Commission, he would purchase the 17-acre property at 49 Randolph Road for the new Vail Sports Club location. The property currently consists of vacant land and a 28,300-square-foot commercial building. The new facility would feature two outdoor synthetic turf fields with lights in addition to 21,000 square feet of indoor sports space to serve as Vail's youth sports clubs, which serve about 700 players from Middletown and surrounding areas. The fields will be used for practices, games, and occasional tournaments. Ettinger has run Vail Sports, which specializes in soccer leagues, clinics, camps, and tournaments since 2018. The club currently rents 40,000 square feet of indoor space at 1280 Newfield Street in Middletown. Vail also rents fields in Meriden, Cromwell, and Xavier High School in Middletown and has a basketball court space in Berlin. "It's our goal to run our organization out of one location," Ettinger said in his project application. His vision for the new facility goes beyond sports fields. Ettinger has a multi-phase master plan for the property that includes redeveloping a 28,300-square-foot industrial warehouse formerly owned by Connecticut Light and Power into a mixed-use entertainment-slash-commercial venue, ideally with residential units above, he said. He would lease out a number of commercial sites in the new space to ventures such as a brewery and have space for food trucks. There could also be a gym for residents, ice cream shop, barber, and office share spaces, he said. The property was last sold in December of 2021 for $2.1 million to 49 Randolph Road, Middletown, LLC. Ettinger is still in the exploratory phase of seeking the zoning approval and possibly buying the property, so he has not yet determined the total investment for the project. Phase one would include the soccer fields and sports facility, followed by the commercial and residential development. Moving along to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This story is titled Atlantic Fabricating Ready for Growth with New Ownership and a Larger Headquarters. 2 years after purchasing South Windsor-based Atlantic Fabricating Company with her husband in 2022, President Kara Dunlap has moved the manufacturer into a new and larger facility in East Granby that will allow for expansion. Atlanta Fabricating is a metalworking, fabrication, and machining business that specializes in building parts and equipment used in the aerospace, alternative and nuclear energy, medical, power generation, maritime, and oil and gas generation industries. The company's customers include East Hartford-based fuel cell manufacturer Hyaxiom and its parent company Doosan, Bloomfield-based Command Corporation, and car makers Chrysler and General Motors. Dunlap and her husband Joseph Dunlap in October paid $1.3 million for the company's new 16,772-square-foot headquarters building at 6 Cripes Road in East Granby and have gradually been moving equipment into the property. Atlanta Fabricating now has 15 employees and room to add more with its new larger headquarters across the river. We do have room for expansion and growth in this site, so that's always a good thing, Dunlap said. We're always looking to expand our capabilities and new machines and upgrade our products. The East Granby building previously hosted Magnatech, an orbital welding equipment manufacturer dating back to 1946. Magnatech was purchased in 2023 by Specialized Fabrication Equipment Group, a company founded in 2019 with the merger of three separate manufacturers. Magnatech has since moved to a smaller space in South Windsor. The Dunlaps purchased Atlantic Fabricating in 2022 from Susan and William Johnson, who were looking to sell and retire. Atlantic Fabricating was founded in 1986 and has been headquartered in South Windsor until the move earlier this year. Dunlap said she and her husband knew Atlantic Fabricating previous owners for more than three decades and had discussed the potential sale several years before it happened. With their interest in retirement and the impact of COVID-19 motivating them further, the opportunity resurfaced, Dunlap said. They were keen to retire, which made the deal more viable. She didn't disclose the terms of the sale. Dunlap has prior experience in sales, finance, and consumer service. Her husband comes from an engineering background. While manufacturing is a new endeavor, Dunlap said the duo believes their combined experience can help grow the company. Their children, Eddie Dunlap and Riley McKay, also work at Atlantic Fabricating. Following the purchase of the company, the Dunlaps invested in software upgrades and newer equipment to expand their client base and allow for more complex projects. They also spruced up their new East Granby facility with new floors, paint, and other much-needed maintenance. Atlantic Fabricating was previously located at 71 Edwin Road in South Windsor, but the lease for that property was up at the end of last year. Rather than renew, the Dunlaps began searching for a new home with the goal of owning real estate. Atlantic Fabricating was also beginning to outgrow its former space due to an increase in order and overall business, Dunlap said. Atlantic Fabricating builds and assembles complete electromechanical systems such as circuit boards, as well as X-ray machines and radiation detection equipment for use in hospitals, construction sites, and by nuclear energy original equipment manufacturers. The company also offers custom fabrication services and produces spare parts for power generation suppliers. Recent growth has come from radiation equipment and circuit board sales, as well as custom welding services and government-related contracts, Dunlap said, adding that the company is always in the market to hire welders and fabricators. Under new ownership, we've expanded our client base to include larger projects like complex modifications of shipping containers and advanced machining and assembly tasks for X-ray and radiation detection equipment, she said. Including outdoor space, Atlantic Fabricating currently uses about 20,000 square feet for operations at its new East Granby location. It has also received town approval to add 20,000 square feet to the property. While no expansion plans have been formalized yet, the company could eventually add to the building or outside storage space. Atlantic Fabricating's South Windsor facility was about 11,000 square feet and spread across three different shop floors, said McKay, who is Atlantic Fabricating's business development manager. It comes down to the flow, having the assembly and clean areas, the fabrication area and the welding area, not just crammed into one spot. It really allows us to do quality work, McKay said of the new facility. Dunlap said the goal is to establish Atlantic Fabricating as the premier source for fabrication and electromechanical assembly along the I-91 corridor. Our intention is to maintain ownership for the foreseeable future and solidify our position in the market, Dunlap said. We're hoping that Riley and Eddie will carry on the company legacy for the long term. Turning to the Biz Brief section of the Hartford Business Journal, Connecticut's economy grew 3.1% in the fourth quarter, estimated 2.1% growth for all of 2023. Connecticut's real GDP grew at 3.1% for the fourth quarter of 2023, placing the state's economic growth slightly below the national average, according to the new data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The U.S. economy grew at 3.4% in the fourth quarter. BEA data shows Connecticut's growth rate ranked 30th out of the 50 states and the District of Columbia.
That's the last article we have time for today. On behalf of Pete and Barry and all of us here at Chris, I thank you for listening. Have a great day.